When you're an entrepreneur doing what we're doing, you cannot be the person who spikes up and has a high stress level. At some level, you have to be wired to actually enjoy it. You have to enjoy when a curveball's thrown at you. You have to enjoy, I'm not saying it's sadistic, but you have to enjoy it. And by the way, if you're not wired that way, sometimes that's actually not the right thing for you to do, is go start a company.
Hi, I'm Jubin, operating partner at Kleiner Perkins, and I'm excited that you're tuning into Grit. The goal of this is not for it to be a highlight reel of how successful my guests are, rather a candid exploration of how hard it is, both personally and professionally, to create, build, and scale world-class organizations. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe, leave a review, and make sure to follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. Thanks.
Have you seen all this stuff going on with like the Reddit?
Saw the IPO. Yeah. It'll be interesting.
Why is it interesting?
Well, it'll be interesting to see the take and what happens and so on.
I'm sure you're particularly interested.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's not the same area, space, domain exactly, but it's around about the same neighborhood.
And there was what was the name of the data center company that also went?
Didn't go out, but was thinking of going out, you mean?
Which one?
Not the storage vendors, you mean?
No.
Yeah, I don't remember the name.
But also went out, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if recently, maybe. I can't remember the name. But there's that, and then there's a couple others, I think, that probably in the wings waiting.
Like who?
Well, there's some storage vendors.
Like Rubrik?
Yeah, Rubrik.
Which has been on the docket. The rumor block for years.
It's been on the docket for a long time.
Yeah.
And so we're all, I think nobody wants to be first.
And that's a great comp for you, right?
Yeah, it would be a good comp. We're not a hardware vendor. They aren't either per se, but they sell hardware.
Right.
And so probably like a pure software SaaS would be a more comparable.
Nobody wants to go first.
Yeah, nobody. Nobody wants to go first. Like, why not? Because they don't know. It's like the risk. They don't know what's going to happen.
Are bankers up your ass about going out?
You know, a true banker who is a true friend, right? Or you can't have a banker and a friend. It could be an oxymoron. But somebody who actually wants to be with you for a long time, they know that, hey, the IPO is not their check. It's the partnership. Long term, I think they would tell you, hey, wait.
Is that what they're telling you?
Yeah, they'll say, wait. They'll go, look, the reality is you got a great company. You don't need the capital. It's not for capital reasons. Some companies go public for capital. Some go for liquidity. Some go for reasons. If you don't have to go for capital, they'd say, wait.
Yeah. You just raised a few hundred million, right?
We raised around 400 million.
When?
About a year and a half ago.
Okay.
We don't need capital.
No.
And we won't. And so for us, it's more awareness. It would be like, look, get the message out.
Brand.
Yeah.
It's a marketing event.
Yeah. Show up on Squawk on the Street. Show up on...
Jim Cramer?
Yeah, joking. I don't know. It's awareness, right? So
yeah.
It's just awareness. That's the main thing for us.
Yeah.
So does that help us get that? Yeah, I think so. But do it when the time's right.
Is the public company, like being a CEO of a public company thing, is that exciting or like, oh God, I really don't want to do that?
Here's the thing.
Honestly.
Like, yeah. For me, the destination is not...
No, come on.
Right?
Don't tell me.
Yeah, yeah, it's not. It's not that. But I do feel like to build the truly iconic cyber networking company, you will have to be public. And why? You'll have to be public because, frankly, just the awareness you get, the brand. Customers literally look at you as a public company, and there is a different view sometimes.
Yeah.
When they're betting.
Especially with security.
Yeah, especially with security. And so I do look forward to being a public company CEO because I haven't done it. I love challenges. I love new things. Mm. I love walking into the unknown and winning in the unknown. And I think something you haven't done is a good thing.
So just speaking of the Reddit thing.
Yeah.
I was like watching one of their founders kind of like go off on Twitter about a lot of stuff. And
yep,
it was their day.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yep.
But it also kind of bummed me out because I was like, oh man, like this is your day and you should appreciate today. But like tomorrow, which is now today.
Yeah.
And then in a week, nobody cares. I had this weird dissonance where I was like watching this person on Twitter have their day. And he's no longer a part of the company, but he was one of the founders. And
yep. He
was just going off. And I realized that so much of him was wrapped up in this thing, which makes sense because it's your baby. But also, I just thought, I don't have a vested interest in this company. And basically nobody else in the world except for a small handful of people that are shareholders or bankers or employees do. Otherwise, no one else gives a shit.
Yeah. the reality is, like, your customers, your end users. Yeah. Reddit's very different than obviously a company like ours in terms of their end users. They want your product. They want the value. They want the, do they care that you're public or private? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Right. And with Reddit, the king of the memes and so on, there is a worry as well, right? Will they become a little bit of their own meme stock?
Totally.
Because the Reddit buyers will buy it.
Totally.
So, yeah.
Make you nervous about the idea of going public?
I think
it's just so unknown, right?
Yeah. When I think about going public, it's not a sudden thing. For me, I've, you know, thought about this. That's what I want to do since I built the company. So sometimes time, as time goes on, you become less nervous about it. I know a lot of public company CEOs. I know a lot of folks who are CFOs. And so I think I don't get nervous. I actually get excited.
Man, I grew up in security. It's so hard. It's such a hard industry to build an independent, huge company. I mean, how many are there? Like pure play security?
Yep.
I can count on maybe one hand.
Yeah. Yeah. It is difficult in cyber. I mean, there are so many companies, and the drop off between companies that go from zero to 10 million to 100 to 250 in ARR to half a billion to, I mean, it's a quick drop off.
Why is that? Because the industry just, the landscape just changes so
much? No, because they're too niche. They're point product companies. And the reality is in today's world, you know, people want to buy some level of a platform. And if you want to build some level of platform, when you wake up and when you look at your investors in the beginning, you got to go, I'm going long. I'm going to be a big fish in a big pond and I'm going to invest hardcore in R&D. And that can make them uncomfortable because they're like, wait, you're going for kind of like a moonshot. Because the number of companies that come out of it to be a large cyber company is super small. Mm. And so some of them are just happy. They're like, let me just go build a company and I'll go sell it. That's good for the VC. It's good maybe for the founder. And so for you to go long on a cyber company, there's very few. And you got to have intestinal fortitude beyond belief.
When you say like do a bunch of R&D up front.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean invest. Invest in R&D.
Did you do that?
Yes.
Give me an example.
So I'll give you an example. I built from the beginning. The goal was I'm going to build a platform. It's going to have 10 different modules. It's going to subsume the biggest market in security. A market that's $30 billion in TAM. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go build that. And guess what? I'm going to build and invest in things that don't release for 3 years. Think about getting your like Series A way back 11 years ago and telling someone that. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to invest $200 million to build a massive network and people can't use it till I'm near done. There's a rare set of investors who will look at that and go, you know what? I'm in because I believe in what you're doing. I believe in your team and it's not for the faint of heart. And the reality is I tell every person who's joined our company, I'm like, it's not for the faint of heart. Now it's a little different. You know, we're at scale. We're extremely well-known. We're a leader. But back then, yeah, it wasn't for everybody.
What was the mission that I think continues to be the mission today?
Our mission is to redefine the biggest market in security. That's called data network security. It's the single largest total addressable market in security. And what it is basically when you go to the internet, you access cloud, SaaS apps, you go back on-prem, well, something is there looking at that, saying, well, is this person malicious? Are they trying to steal my data? Are they trying to download malware? How do I protect that traffic? Mm. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And the market has a name now, it's called SASE, has a quadrant, has all the rest. It's just matured.
When you were leaving Juniper to do this, did you know that this was the thing that you wanted to do?
Here's what I knew. I knew I wanted to build and innovate and build a legacy professionally. That's what I knew. And I knew I couldn't do that at Juniper. And I knew that I couldn't do it unless I did what I love, which is start from scratch. When I left Juniper, there was a bunch of big trends happening. One was SaaS and cloud. Second was slow usage of remote work. And then mobile. The confluence of those three things transformed everything in, you know, security and networking.
What's a professional legacy? Like, what does that actually mean to you?
What it means to me is when I look back, I say, I built something. I built something with tens of thousands of people who you changed their lives. You changed their lives both financially, their family. They look back. They could be an engineer. They could be a sales. They look back and go, that was the best time of my life professionally. Working with that team, I loved coming in. I made a big impact. And we put a big stamp on the industry that won't be forgotten. That's what I mean by professional legacy. And that's really what I'm after.
So you didn't have the Netskope idea lined up, more the scaffolding of you've been in this industry for a while. You see a set of tailwinds that are clearly happening in the shift from on-prem to cloud. you know that there's going to have to be a whole redefining of the security posture as data moves to the cloud, and you want it to be a part of that.
Yeah, I wanted to lead it because I felt like all the existing vendors in that space, many, some are still there today, they were pushing the old. And I felt like I got to take a blank whiteboard and we got to do this right. And it's a generational opportunity because that doesn't come along very often where you have a confluence of those trends leading to that opportunity. So,
and you did this once before where you started a company called Ingrian, right?
Yeah.
Did it fail? Did it get acquired?
It got acquired. Yeah. And I would tell you that when I look back in that time, I started as one of the founding engineers. By the way, I don't know if you know the story. I was at Stanford and I was running out of money. I'm like, crap, you know. I don't know if they didn't convert Canadian currency to U.S. currency when I came here, but after one quarter, I can't pay for my second quarter. So at Stanford. And so actually helped start a company with a professor out of Stanford. That product still exists today. Got bought by HP. It's funny because full circle, when I'm at Netskope, I got a PO for that product. My team was buying that product.
Come on.
Yeah.
You said, don't touch it.
No, I said, it's the same name. But the price is four times. And I'm like, that's what they innovated on after they bought it? They jacked up the price? So that was kind of a full circle moment. But here's what I always tell people. You got to learn from what you do wrong. And, you know, watching. I wasn't the CEO, but watching, sitting in a board meeting, watching what was good. A lot of great things, but also missteps in terms of, you know, going after the opportunity. And for me, that was a great, great experience.
Raised a bunch of money too. At that point, $50 million. This was right before the things went bust.
Yes, right before.
And it was an encryption company. My first job was at an encryption company.
Oh, really?
What a brutal, brutal space.
It is a brutal space. But I tell you today, everybody needs it. Like the reason we bought that product from the company that I started was we needed it.
Can you imagine me pitching AES 256-bit encryption? What are we kidding me right now?
Way.
I mean, it was brutal.
I remember my crypto course at Stanford. After that course, I went, I am not built for this. So,
and so you go to McAfee, spend a year there.
Yeah.
Then you go to Juniper. You spend 8-9 years.
Yeah.
And you leave as the VP and GM of their security business, basically.
Yeah.
Really great job. Like, and at that point, Juniper was a very legit company.
Yeah, totally.
2012 is not what Juniper is today.
Yep.
It was a bellwether of the network and security industry.
Yeah, they were doing well. But the reality is this. I kind of saw the writing on the wall, to be frank, in the security business at that company. And you got to have your whole heart in it. You got to invest in the future. And the reality is with those trends that I saw, I realized that, you know what? Companies that are entrenched, they like to milk their cash cow. And they're not going to look at a blank whiteboard and start over, which is the right thing. And I realized I'm going to go do this.
Do you wish you did it earlier?
It's a good question. I don't because of this reason. As I go through my career, I started in the help desk at 16 to get enough money to go to university. That's where my first exposure to IT was. And all the way to, for example, being in engineering, running product, being kind of in sales, selling, to being a GM and running market. All of those things led up to me being ready to start a company and run it. Mm. Without those experiences, I feel like I would have made missteps or more missteps. Everybody makes missteps at Netskope. And all of that background prepared me for it. So I feel like I did it at the right time.
Why do you say it was a good question?
It's a good question because a lot of people may say, hey, you could have started something like 15 years ago.
Right.
And taken advantage of this trend. But I always tell people like, look, an idea and an opportunity is not enough. You need to understand how to build that team. You need to understand how to sell. You need to understand how to execute and build ultimately a great go-to-market strategy. And I feel the last 15 years before Netskope, it helped me build the go-to-market side and how to do that right. And I love it.
How long was the writing on the wall for you?
I would say I got hungry probably. And I remember talking actually even to Mamoon over at Kleiner. It was like 2010. And obviously it wasn't here then, but even back then.
What'd you talk to him about?
He would talk to me about companies perhaps he had and, hey, why don't you come and be the CEO of this company or why don't you go back to what you love, which is building. And through that, talking to others as well, I realized, you know what? I want to go build from scratch. And so I would say that's sort of when I knew.
There was never a inkling of you taking on a CEO gig of another company?
There was, but in the end, in my heart, I realized when I thought about professional legacy, when I thought about what I love to do, I don't want to come in and fix something. I wanted to come in and build it. built it ground up the way I wanted to. And I wanted to experience doing that from the very beginning. So it's more what I wanted to do.
And so you leave.
Yeah.
By the way, I sent it to Mamoon yesterday, but there was a post that he wrote.
Yeah.
That's on the Netscope website from 2005.
Yeah.
About the story of you and him. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's a relic of the past.
Yeah, it is a relic. I love Mamoon. I mean, Mamoon was my first investor. He put the first money in Netscope.
Which, he was pretty young in his career, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. But he was hit after hit, right? He'd invested in Box.
Yeah.
Right? He'd invested in a bunch of other companies, later on Slack, later on. And so it was hit after hit, and I loved him.
Oh, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Was he an obvious choice back then?
No. No, because first of all, I got to know him. And when I think about investors, I'm like, the wrong time to get to know them is when you're trying to get capital. And I filter on culture. I want to know, are these people honest, integrity? Are they going to be open and direct? But are they good people? Because, you know, a bad board member can kill your company. And for Mamoon, as I got to know him, I'm like, he was my type of person.
Yeah.
It became an obvious choice, but obvious sometimes to people as well. It's that brand. It's that name, because they're the big brand of an investor or the big name. And I'm the opposite. I'm like, that's not what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking for the big brand or the big name. I'm looking for the right person.
Yeah. And he was a social capital at the time.
He was. Yeah, absolutely.
And you talked to him 2 years before.
Yeah.
And then what? Like, you do the Sandhill tour?
No, not really. I didn't do a tour. I basically left, knew what I wanted, you know, formed my idea, what I wanted to do. And I just sat down with the people that I trusted and built a relationship with already. To me, the Sandhill tour was, wait a minute, I'm ready now and I'm going to go meet people I don't know and get to know them in that moment. That's the wrong way to raise capital. It's the wrong way to pick your board. And so I knew and I trusted Mamoon, kept up to date on what we were doing, and off we went.
Interestingly, he's not even really a security investor.
Totally. But here's the thing. Like, so when you think about a board member, and if you're going long to build a great company,
yeah,
and you're picking your first investors, like, do they need to be the domain expert? You should be the domain expert. Mm. What they should be an expert in is, A, they should be an expert in being a great partner who understands how it is like as an entrepreneur building your company. They understand, in this case, SaaS and cloud and how that works and perhaps the metrics. But three, the biggest thing is they're trusted. Imagine being on a board. As you build a company, you go through ups and downs. You need somebody who, frankly, is going to be what we say, understanding, entrepreneur friendly, and isn't just going to go knee jerk left, right.
Yeah.
And Mamoon's the person for that.
I completely agree. To put a bow on it, because I don't want to gas up Mamoon too much. This is your spotlight here. But there's two things that strike me about him that are very unique in a human being.
Yeah.
The first is his long-term orientation and patience is like I've never seen before.
Totally.
Almost to the point of frustration where I'm like, how? How can you wait so much out?
Yeah.
And that matches very well to a 10 to 15 year journey for an entrepreneur.
Yeah, totally.
The second is that I think he has a unique understanding of how messy company building is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think he just knows that it's such an imperfect game.
Totally. And enterprise. He knows some of the nuances of what that's like.
Yeah. And I think that there's a level of empathy that comes with an understanding of how the journey has so many kind of like twists, turns, ups and downs.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just messy.
It is. Yeah. I tell people, when you look afar, 100 feet, 1,000 feet, you look at a company like ours and you go, wow, that's great. It's up and to the right. It's a straight line.
Yeah.
When you get in the company, you realize there's no company like that. It's a jagged line up and to the right.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between someone I think who understands and someone who perhaps read a textbook.
Well, I think you really understand when you are a part of as many bangers as he is, that you see under the hood of those and they're all a mess.
Yeah, totally.
they're a mess.
Yeah.
And, you know, unless you've been an employee at one of these companies or a Netscope or something, right? I bet you there's people now that from the outside are like, wow, this company is about to go public and they're growing at this amazing clip.
Yeah.
And then they join and they're like, wait.
Yeah.
What?
I got to do this. I have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even now.
Yeah. Even in a public company, people don't get it. It's just the reality. And the reality is, if that wasn't the case, maybe the company didn't set their sights high enough. Because at every level and every scale, you should be twisting and turning and being uncomfortable. And if you didn't, then maybe, you're complacent.
Yeah. How long from fundraise did it take to get to your first million of ARR?
Yeah, from fundraise, it took us a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah. Basically, we fundraised, we released our product, I'd say just over a year in. Obviously, after the first year, we were over a million.
And then from a million to what the next year?
A million, we kind of went the tripling, you know, quadrupling, and then kept going.
Yeah. You did the triple, triple, double,
yeah,
double.
Yeah, yeah, we did. Yeah. You know, for us, it's been just over 10 years now since 10 we started. Yeah, just over 10 years. We released our product just over 9 years ago.
When you were leaving Juniper, were you married?
Yes. When I left Juniper, I was married. I had a 1.5-year-old daughter.
Where were you living?
At that time, at Juniper, I used to live in the peninsula.
Okay.
And then I moved down south.
Okay.
Part of this sort of, I moved down south. One, I could be closer to where my office was.
At Juniper?
Well, no, actually, when I was at Juniper, I was commuting.
Yeah.
I moved down south because I knew where I was going to start my company.
You're kidding.
Yes. And then my wife also had moved her office where she worked. And I also wanted...
She also works.
Yeah, she also works full time. And
so you move. Can I ask you some personal
questions?
Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
Your mortgage on your head is bigger or less than the previous?
It's bigger.
Bigger.
Yeah.
Help me understand the equation there. You're putting a bigger mortgage on your head.
Yeah.
Your comp is going from whatever, a lot to a little.
Yeah. How does that work?
How does that work? Yeah. And your wife is scratching her head probably.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. When I realized what I was going to do, the only person I talked to was my wife and said, look, I'm going to do this. And she looks at me and goes, look, I know you. There's no answer other than go do it. And you'll be unhappy. You won't come home vitalized. You won't want to do. And so my daughter was 1.5 and so she didn't have a vote. So,
yeah.
But for us, it was like, look, you got to capture the moment. You can be waiting your whole life to do something and then your life's over. And so my whole point was, look, this is the time. There's a confluence of things. We'll go do it and we'll figure it out. And we did.
Do you not stress?
Here's the thing. This is a bad and a good thing, okay? I do have ability to compartmentalize. That's good sometimes at work. Not necessarily always good at home, by the way.
Yeah.
To compartmentalize. Yeah. But here's the thing, like, does everybody stress? But I tell people, when you're an entrepreneur doing what we're doing, you cannot be the person who spikes up and has a high stress level. At some level, you have to be wired to actually enjoy it. You have to enjoy when a curveball's thrown at you. You have to enjoy, I'm not saying it's sadistic.
It's a bit sadistic.
But a little bit. But you have to enjoy it. And by the way, if you're not wired that way, sometimes that's actually not the right thing for you to do, is go start a company. And that's why I tell everybody joins in the beginning. I was like, it's not for the faint of heart to try to filter out people because you need the right people with the right emotional structure. But of course I stress and people do, but not to the degree that many may.
Yeah, you don't strike me as someone that gets that stressed out.
No, I think like, here's the thing. You got to have perspective in your life too. And if you have a family and you have a daughter and you've gone through stuff with it, you have perspective. And your perspective is like, look, we're all so damn fortunate in this world. Look where we got food, we got a family. You know, there's a hell of a lot of people who have stress for real reasons. Not because, oh no, something went wrong. I didn't hire this person or I didn't hit this number exactly or I didn't. And so I think perspective helps. And then you got to be wired differently.
You think you're wired differently?
I can tell you that I'm definitely wired differently than many of the folks who always come up and go, I don't know how you do this. I don't know. I couldn't do this.
I believe you're one of the good, really good guys in tech. And by the way, your approval rating, the company's approval rating on Glassdoor shows it. I've never seen an approval rating like yours as a CEO.
I haven't looked at it.
It's like 97%.
Got it.
It's insane.
Got it.
Anyway, it's clear that you genuinely are a very good human being. Does that fool people? Does this nice guy thing lead people astray?
You have to be authentic and genuine. I think that's the number one thing anybody wants. Even a customer, a partner, an employee, an investor, like just like tell me how it is. Be authentic. And by the way, that's what I look for when I look for an investor. And so I think authentic is probably the right word versus a nice person. Mm. And I think like maybe it's our background, you know, stereotypical Canadian, but you know, we do have a bent to caring about people and not just about, hey, the end result in your company. You kind of, I tell people like one of our traits is do it the right way. For example, selling. I don't go and sell and throw FUD. I don't go throw dirt on competitors. I sell in substance. And I kind of feel like, look, when I put my head on the pillow, I'm like, you know what? That's the right way to do it. I don't know about nice. We, in the world that we live in, is pretty cutthroat. Like you look at enterprise sales, you look at, it's cutthroat. You have to be authentic. You have to keep your integrity, but it doesn't mean, nice doesn't mean you don't make the hard decisions.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a big difference.
Yeah. I have seen even many not nice CEOs not be able to make the hard decisions.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And, yeah. When you were younger, you were a paper boy. Okay, wait, question for you.
Yeah.
You were a paper boy for 15 years?
I never got promoted, man. It's like, why am I still doing this?
What is the paper boy thing was one thing, but to see you do it for 15 years.
Here's the thing. So my mom started as a door-to-door salesperson. So she started as an Amway, Regal, Avon salesperson, like literally. And I was the one at 5-6 packing the little boxes, whatever she was selling, and we would go door to door. I would create, even an helper create pamphlets. I would deliver them, and I'd deliver them for others too, to maximize multiple things you're delivering. But I got into that super early. And I also got into selling super early. Now, it was only later I realized my mom was in the bottom of a Ponzi scheme for most of her life. But anyways, we got in early because we were selling early. And so for me, delivering could be her material, could be her pamphlets, others. It was just, that's how we got money. And I thought it was cool. I was outside. I was doing what I love, getting exercise. And so it wasn't a bad thing.
Was it just you and your mom?
It was me, my mom, and then I have a brother, and then my dad.
Okay.
So that was us. That was the family. They were first generation, moved, and then my brother and I were born in Canada, in Toronto.
And so you're biking around.
Yeah.
On the paper route, most of the time helping your mom.
Yeah.
Make ends meet.
Yeah, absolutely. Biking, walking, you know. It was only later in life that I became to love dogs again, because I can't tell you how many times I got bit by going up to a
house. It's like out of a movie.
It's out of a movie. And I'm serious. Bite you on the ear, bite you everywhere. After a while, I'm like, jeez. So it took me a while.
What did watching your mom do for you doing that type of work? That's hard work.
Yeah, it's hard. Hard work. If you look at just somebody with tenacity, you know, there's a saying I have. I mentioned my company. I have some concept of grit, and I have an acronym for it. And one of them is tenacity. That was my mom. She would never give up. She was in the bottom of this selling scheme, and she would fight. She would sell whatever. She'd sell lipsticks door to door. That's what she did for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And seeing that, and seeing that drive, and, you know, frankly, being a woman doing it at that time, it leaves an impression on you.
Which was what?
The impression that it leaves on you is, wow, you know, someone who is driven, someone who really wants something, someone who will fight through any obstacle. I mean, you know how many times you're said no to? You're said no to 99 of 100 times. And you just wake up with a smile and you go, wow, why is this person doing this? Well, they're doing it because, not just because they want to help their family, but they want to do it because they want to make it. And then to see my mom progress from that to become eventually one of the most successful real estate people in Canada, just to see that journey, which took a long time, 30, 40 years, but just to see that progression tells you what hard work can do.
Did you grow up in a good neighborhood?
Look, I cannot complain about the neighborhood I grew up in. First of all, I grew up in Canada, in Toronto and Mississauga area eventually. Yeah. And it was a fine neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah. I really look back on them and think, wow, what they imprinted on us still holds today.
Is she?
My mom still lives in Mississauga. My dad passed away a while ago, and my mom lives alone. To do that, she will, starchly independent, will still live alone. I will make her come out here often as much as I can, and we'll go visit. But yeah, she's still out there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I bet that there was probably something to you going and doing this and seeing the value of selling.
Yeah.
Of like understanding how important that is in the day to day.
Yeah. Look, the reality is, as everybody knows, and it's been said 500 different ways, right? You can have a great team and a great product, but if you can't sell it and you can't market it, it doesn't matter. And I love selling. And
you do?
Oh yeah. I love getting in front of customers. I love getting in front of partners. I love getting on an audience. I love it. I can't prepare. I don't like rehearsing. I don't like rehearsing when I'm presenting. I like to speak, right? Comes from your heart. You know it. And I have a rule in my company that for myself, that I need to talk to 2 CXOs a day. Those are my customers or my prospects. I got to hit 2 of them in a day, because I tell people, you live in the clouds. You know, you're running a company. You could say you live in the clouds, kind of symbolic of what we do, but you got to live in the trenches. And the trenches are when you sell, when you talk to your customers and prospects, when you sit down with a salesperson or an engineer, or You got to live there. You got to know what's happening on the ground, because otherwise you don't know which way to steer without some primary data. And so I love it. I love selling.
And so your sales team will set up 2 a day.
Yeah, or I will. I'll help them. I'll go, look, we can't get to this CIO or CISO. And as you know, in enterprise sales, it is as much about politics and as much about air cover as it is about your product and getting it a value. You got to get there. And you got to build a relationship. They got to know who you are. They got to know that they can trust you. And so, yes, with our field teams, myself, I mean, I still hunt on LinkedIn to find out, how do we get to this person?
You're sending emails.
Not emails. I'll hunt on LinkedIn to see who are they connected to that we can get to. In fact, we automate it now, obviously, where amongst everybody we know, you can put in a name. I'll tell you, here's the best way to get to that person. But in many cases, I'll go and try to get to them. And I am a big believer, everybody in your company needs to be selling. Everybody. Being the CEO, you got to lead the way in that.
Can you talk more about the grit value in the company?
Yeah, it's funny because when you and Mamoon reached out talking about the grit podcast, I was like, well, first of all, I had two things. I'm like, well, I'll do anything for Mamoon. That was one. And then two, grit. I'm like, I just gave out the grit award in my company on stage in my sales kickoff. And that word in the past 18 months is one of my favorite words. I have two words. Grit is one of them, and it's an acronym. It stands for guts, resolve, initiative, and tenacity. And so I changed it to now guts, resolve, integrity, and tenacity. And for me, what I ask of all my people, especially in the field, is you got to have grit. You got to have guts, resolve, integrity, do it the right way, and tenacity. And what does that mean? It means that nobody's going to give you anything in our world. For example, we fight really only public companies, like who have been around for a while, you know, 15, 20,000 people in their company, we're 3,000. And so nobody's going to give us anything. We got to go get it. And you got to have the guts to go get it. You got to have the resolve, and you got to do it the right way, right? Integrity. And you got to have, you know, what I talked to about my mom, tenacity to do it. And so grit for me is like one of the most key ingredients to success at our scale and stage. Mm-hmm. So I feel strongly about that concept.
Yeah. I would argue that it's not just at your stage. I think grit is the number one leading indicator of success for any person in any endeavor.
Yeah.
Is the ability to go get it and overcome the challenges that come with going and getting it.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Like, this is just a small example, but you could hire somebody and they could be a salesperson covering, I don't know, North Carolina. And you could look at two people and one could have a killer resume. Wow, you've been in all these great companies. You hit President's Club all the time. And then you could look at somebody else who's maybe, they haven't done that yet because they're younger in their career, or, you know, maybe they weren't at exactly those companies. And a lot of people go to the first. My question to each of them is, how are you wired? Do you have the drive? Do you have it in you to go get it? Or are you going to say, oh, you know, I need my channel guy, my SDR. I need all these people to help me and surround me with these people. And then I'll go chase after that. The reality is I probably look at the second person and look at them and see, wow, they got a lot more resolve.
How do you test for that?
Well, you test for it multiple ways. You ask questions.
How?
Like, for example, if I'm interviewing you, I would say, okay, hey, here's your territory. Here's your accounts. You don't have a sales development rep. You got to prospect yourself. You got to get into these accounts yourself. Tell me, how are you going to do it? Or can you do it? Or will you do it? And a lot of them will say, well, no, I really need my XYZ and this and this and this. And then I can, and just by their answers alone. Two, I always ask them, hey, by the way, what we do is not for the faint of heart. I make it sound even worse. I go, it's not for the faint of heart. Nobody's going to come up to you and say, I want to talk to you. You got to go get it yourself. So tell me, are you good with that environment? And many of them self-select out because they don't want it. And so I think, like, you got to ask these questions, and it's not just for you, it's for them. You don't want to hire somebody who really at their stage in their life is not a good fit. It's not going to be good for them either. And so I think it's important to kind of just have that honest conversation. I hired my head of sales. I told them when I was closing them, you're not going to be my head of sales in 3 years. And they went, what are you doing? You're trying to close me? Nobody's ever said that. You're trying to close me to be your head of sales. And you just told me I'm not going to be your head of sales in 3 years. And I'm like, yeah, but you get it, right? You understand where we're going to be in 3 years. And at that scale, are you going to want to do that? Will you be capable of doing it? And in the end, they're like, you're kind of right. And our point was, you'll still be here. But at that point, we'll bring somebody in for that level and that operational capability. And so I think having those authentic conversations with people helps.
it strikes me because that idea of hiring the fancy pedigree,
yeah.
I call it fool's gold. It's the number one bane of startups' existence is the hiring for a LinkedIn profile.
Totally. Not just hiring. I'll give you this great example, real example. Board members. Hey, you should really have another board member. And, oh, wow, here's this amazing name of a person. They've done all these things. Now they should come on your board. And I'd always look at it and go, okay, but let me talk to them. Let me see what the kind of fire they have. Will they ever stand up in front of our room and go, hey, when I did this 15 years ago, this is how I did it, and that's how you need to do it? Or will they know and be more open and go, wait a minute, you know, actually, let me listen to how the world works today, how your business works. And you don't want pontificators either. And so what I always tell people is I'm not looking for the big name. I'm looking for the people who actually fit the culture I want. They're open, they're collaborative, they're smart, they're in it to win it like we are, and they got the drive. And not the name, because many times the name is not relevant anymore.
What do you mean it's not relevant anymore?
Look, a lot of times like in our industry, go, hey, the person who 30 years ago,
right,
the world is different.
Right.
Right. And the way we sell is different. The way product's different. Now, some of those people are great.
Right.
My point is like, you can't go just by the name and brand. Think about it. When I picked even my investors, I didn't go for the name and the brand at that time.
Yeah.
That's kind of the world, I think.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
how I'm wired.
It reminds me of many of my operating partner peers that have all the other venture firms that are drawing on their 30 years of experience 30 years ago at XYZ.
By company. The way, and some of them are great. Some of them are just amazing. They've adapted. They rolled with industry. They're, and they're one of my most valuable board members. My point is, though, you can't go off the LinkedIn profile.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think it's well said. When you test for these things, don't you feel pressure? Because isn't there a lot more inherent risk by not choosing pedigree?
Here's the way I think about it. I filter first. Let's say you're hiring whatever domain or function. Filter on culture first. If they're not the cultural fit, they're going to fail. The system will spit them out. Like if they're not a collaborator, they're not open, they're not direct, it'll just spit them out. They won't succeed. They won't hire. They won't. They'll create a lot of bullshit politics, you know, all sorts of stuff. And you just don't want that. Keep it out of your company. It's toxic. So that's one. Number two is, given what you want to do, the pedigree is great in our case if they're hunters. And I'll give you an example. Like you could have an amazing pedigree, but you're a farmer. You need something to be there and you'll maintain it and you'll curate it. But in many cases, when you are innovating and moving quick and building, you want hunters, people who there is no farm. They go build it. They go kill it. They go get it. And those are just different personas. And so pedigree is fine if the pedigree hasn't led them to the point in their life where they don't have the drive to be a hunter. Instead, they just want to take over something and operate and maintain it.
What's the lowest point so far of this journey for you?
I would say the lowest point for me, which is kind of personal, is when my dad passed away. I was building my company. I kind of built it for also so my parents would be very proud because they helped build our family through, I think, from nothing. And so for me, it was probably during that phase, probably in my third or fourth year when that happened. And I had to choose and go, okay, you know what? In his last month, because it happened suddenly, I'm going to be with him. I'm not going to focus on my company. I knew every day that he would be proud of what we did and what we've done. That was probably my hardest point, especially right after having to walk on stage, after the funeral, after all the rest, go on stage in my SKO to kick off the next year.
And get the troops fired up?
Yeah. That was a difficult moment. So,
did you talk about it?
I didn't.
Do you regret that?
I wasn't ready to talk about it at that point. And so I don't regret it at that point, but to turn that, knowing that, you know, that happened, but I want to go fire my troops. And I know that's what my dad wanted because he was so proud of what I was building. That was difficult.
When you found out that life was short.
Yeah.
What do you mean you paused? Like you paused on Netscope?
Well, what I mean was I'm a family guy. I visit my family all the time. When that happened suddenly, like literally person's fine. And then suddenly they call and go, hey, you need to come here. I'm going to the IR or the ICU. I was there the entire time, just sitting there. I wouldn't work. You just had to put it on pause.
Nothing.
Yeah, because you're consumed by trying to figure out what's going on. Yeah, you go talk to doctors, you go talk to universities, try to, hey, can you help us solve this thing? They don't know what's wrong. And so you kind of turn all your eyes to that. And I think perspective in your life is like nothing's more important than your family. That's what helped me through that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after to get on to then realize that, okay, you got to keep going.
You didn't do any work at that point.
The work that I did would be like, look, I got people that I've brought on, and for this period of time, I'm going to ask you, these are the things I'm going to ask you to do and drive. Come to me if you need help, but I'm not going to be as available during this time anymore. That was the right call.
Was there even a decision in your mind?
No, not in my mind. It was more that you have two families.
Right.
When you build a company, you got your company and you got all the people who are, you know, you want them to succeed and they're dependent in some case on you. And then you have your other family and they merge, your immediate family, they kind of merge because they're all so ingrained in what you do. But ultimately, I always tell my people, and we have people go through this day, I'm like, look, if you ever have a situation like that, your family, your company family is there for you. And the first thing they should tell you is do not focus on work. Go take care of your number one family. And that's the motto I follow with anybody in my company. And I would follow it for myself too.
Yeah. Well, you did.
Yeah.
What was that feeling inside getting on stage?
It was kind of mixed. It was like, okay, look, first of all, I love this, what we're building. I love the company. It's kind of my passion. It's also, I know my dad was so proud of it. So I was kind of also like, okay, I'm back doing this. And it just gave you more inspiration, if anything, to make it successful. And that's kind of how I used it. It was like, you know what? Going to make them proud.
Yeah.
I got through it. So.
Why was it so hard? Meaning, why was the balance of those two things so hard?
They're intense. Super. I mean, when you're building a company and it's any stage, it's intense. It's all consuming every day. I mean, you're on. It could be on now. I'll leave this and probably got X text. Or, I mean, it is intense. And that's why I say it's not for the faint of heart. You're not ever off.
You feel on all the time?
Yeah, you are.
Do you feel that way?
You're there all the time, but that's why you have to love it. So I'll give you an example. There's always on, meaning that you're sitting in front of your computer or you're going traveling all the time and you're, and I tell, but that's not sustainable. What I mean by always on is you have to be ready to deal with something or you have to be ready to ad hoc respond to something. It doesn't mean that you go and spend 18 hours a day working. I think that kills you. I take my daughter to her basketball games. If she has a basketball game in the evening, I'm taking her to that game. So it doesn't mean that I won't be on, meaning, okay, after when she's sleeping, I'm going to go and catch up and do stuff, or maybe there's some urgent thing that came in. But I am a big believer that sustainability in your company is you do have to prioritize and your family does come first. And if you're going to build a legacy company, I'll be here in 10 years doing this. The fuel is your company, but it's also your family. And so you got to feed that. And even though you're always on, it doesn't mean that you're not always on for them as well.
Do you not get exhausted?
I don't, because I love it. This isn't a job for me. Building Netskope, I love it. It is what I want to do. It is what I have the energy to do. It is what I get excited about. Like when I go and talk to a customer or I go focus on, we're going to buy this company and we're going to fit into our strategy, or I'm talking to a product or going to talk to, be at an investor conference. I love it. I love doing that. And so for me, it's not like work. And if you don't have that, then it's very difficult to do, I think, what we do.
Did you feel that way when you were at Juniper?
Definitely not in the last years. No way. It was work.
Yeah.
And as soon as you lose that thirst, I think it's time to go.
Yeah. Do you still not have an office?
Yeah, we have lots.
No, you.
Oh, no, I don't have an office.
You don't have an office?
No, never have. Never.
Never.
No.
3,000 people.
Yeah, we have a sea of desks and I just sit in one of the desks.
You just take a desk.
Yeah. Yeah, because also like you get to know so many people. They walk by. Now, you got a meeting. Yeah, of course, you're going to go into a conference room and take your meeting and it could be, but no, that's what I mean by live in the clouds and live in the trenches. And sitting in your office with your door closed, it's not approachable. You don't get to feel the culture and the blood of what's going on in your company. The reality is today, nobody sits in any desk in an office anyways. We have offices throughout the world. Like half our people don't even live in North America. We got offices in Madrid and London and over India and Colombia. And when you think even about an office nowadays, I'm like, how do you sit where you can see everybody in this virtual world? And I've created mechanisms to do that too, where I have like open doors where I have for hours, just people can get on the Zoom call and they can ask me whatever they want in every single region. And you got to create this way where you're available and open, even in this virtual working world.
Where does that most benefit and where does that break down in the like sitting in on a random desk?
I think where it most benefits is one, you are approachable. You are visible. You are reinforcing your culture, which in our case is be open, be direct. So it is like a very visible form of reinforcement of all of that.
Yeah.
Second is, I can't tell you how many people would come by and want to talk. And what I gleaned out of that was probably more valuable than what perhaps they gleaned from my response even. And you get so much information that you just couldn't get as you grow. Now, if you're 20 people or 100 people, it's a little different. But as you grow, right, 3,000 people where we are and more, it's more difficult. And so that's the benefit. The disadvantage is you can get a lot of interruptions. And so you do have to make sure that you're structured.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But like, isn't it kind of annoying? Like most of your conversations are pretty sensitive in nature, aren't they?
Well, that's what I said. We go into a conference room. Like if I have a meeting that is sensitive or actually a meeting in general, I wouldn't want to do it in the open because everybody, first of all, you're not even respecting their time and so on. So you do that in the conference room.
Yeah, that makes sense. You have almost 3,000 people?
Yeah.
How do you think about when you hire people now, the people that got you to this point are very different than the people that will get you to the next point?
Absolutely. Is that example, like I said, in when I was hiring my head of sales, won't be my head of sales in 3 years. That's sort of like a example, but it's in every function. And so look, there's different people for different stages of your company. And in every role, could be your HR team, could be your head of sales, could be your product person, could be, you know, go down the list, your finance person. And the reality is that you have to be savvy enough to understand that, but you also have to be savvy enough to understand that there are some people who can grow and stay in that role. And those are those special people who can be with you throughout the whole time. And I think that's just a realization of selling at different stages and building your company. Because I was at large companies, started at Microsoft, was at Juniper, then at small companies. And at mid, I saw it. I see what it's like. Mm. And it kind of have this understanding of, hey, when do I need to...
When you find those people that seemingly can infinitely scale,
yeah,
you hold on for dear life, what do you do?
You bring those people close, you incent them. They can't just be incented monetarily, they have to be incented in their heart. And because if you have an open, direct culture, those people, they want to be fed. They want to be aware of what's going on. They want to be part of the decisions. They don't want to just be, hey, let's go do this. And so you hold those people close. And there's a rare breed though, because like in different functions, I had a head of sales. He was my head of sales for 9 years. That's insane. He scaled in every single way till he retired from the industry. And I could not be more thankful for that person.
Out of 100 people, how many do you think are that person?
If you had 100 people, how many could go all the way? I'll take, so out of the 100, remove the engineering people.
Okay.
Because engineers can, their role and their job won't vary as much as if you're in a leader. So remove all the individual engineers and so on, and remove some of this individual salespeople. I would say like, if you look at leadership, so mid to high end leadership, out of 100 that could scale all the way from nothing to like where we are now, I don't know, like two.
Two is nothing.
Yeah, because I mean, look at the history of companies you have. Who are the people who traditionally would stay? There'll be your founders. There'll be your technical people, like your CTO and obviously engineers. Name a company where they're head of sales. I mean, we're a rarity where we had one that stayed. That's going to be difficult. Your finance person, you think like a public company CFO is going to come to some company that is just trying to get 5 or 10 million. Then HR, I'm like, first HR person you handle is like an HR manager. Mm-hmm. It's not a CHRO.
Yeah.
Your product person is possible to stay. Then you go to legal. Well, no general legal counsel has to deal with, we have to deal with hundreds of countries, regulatory frameworks. They're not going to come to a company that has, is just starting. And so you just go through each function and you kind of go, yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. When does your intensity ratchet up the most? Like when do you get the most competitive?
First of all, I try to be relatively even keel, meaning like, hey, I don't want to go down too much or high too much. But like when I get super competitive is when I feel we've been wronged.
Give me an example.
let's say you're trying to win a customer and you win. You're winning. Your platform's the best. You work through and you got the win. Then you have somebody who goes up and goes, talks to their friend through somebody else who's the CEO of this company you're selling to and goes, hey, you should just buy from us. I know you. And they override the decision of their people. That pisses me off. And by the way, that does happen because like when I came to the Bay Silicon Valley, I knew no one. I didn't know the network. I didn't know the crowd. When I grew up, I didn't know all the big CIOs and CISOs and the people I were competing with. Maybe they did because they knew them for like 20 years. And what got me was the politics. What really kills me is when the politics, whether it's in a company, whether it's in a community, whether it's in whatever, when that is what wins out. That ratchets up my intensity because I feel like that's been wronged. That's not the eye of integrity and grit. And so for me, those things really get me.
Why'd you change the eye from initiative to integrity?
Because two things. I'm a big believer that you do it right. Like when I look back, we're not trying to build a company for 5 years. I'll be doing this, doing it for 10, doing it for another 10 more and more. And I feel like that in your heart is the right way to do it. Like I'll feel good, right? When I put my head on my pillow. But also I do think the industry recognizes that. If you're in it to build a relationship with somebody, 5 years down the road, they're going to look at you and go, hey, I can trust that person. They got integrity versus the drive-by sale or the drive-by X where many times the integrity gets thrown out. And that's not the way we operate and that's not what we ask. And so that's why.
What's the most surprising thing that you didn't expect running a 3,000-person company now?
The amount of politics.
Internally?
Not internally, externally. Just selling.
And internally.
Internally, as you scale, I mentioned like different people for different levels.
Yeah.
When you bring in people at different levels and you bring in someone who's seen, oh yeah, I've been at a public like company or been you, those people have been at large companies, which have politics and a lot of it. And what you have to be careful of, which I learned some through mistakes, is you have to get the people who in those companies were not the creators of the politics or who didn't feed on it or didn't get acclimatized to it. And so that's one. And then external, the amount of politics in selling is insane. In companies, the amount of things that are almost done because people know each other. For me, I didn't realize the magnitude of that in enterprise.
Like in a Fortune 100
or everywhere,
sale.
Everywhere. I tell people like, it's not just for the faint of heart because you're starting and going against and trying to redefine an industry and going from scratch. I tell people it's not for faint of heart because you don't know what you're getting into with hardcore enterprise sales. We're different now, of course, because we are much more mature and larger, but you got to be ready for that.
Yeah, it's no joke.
No joke. No joke at all.
Yeah. Well, dude, I really appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, of course. I mentioned, I love it. Love talking and I would do anything for our friend.
Yeah. So, are you hiring?
Yes. You can go on our site or hiring in every geo.
Across all functions.
Yeah. So we're hiring in sales. If you're a great sales team, great sales rep, great SE, US, Europe, Latin America, Asia Pacific, Australia, Japan, wherever, we're hiring. If you're in engineering, we're hiring. It could be in Europe, in Madrid or London, it could be in India, it could be in Taiwan, it could be in Latin America or US, we're hiring. If you're in one of those two areas, and now I'm selling, and you're a great person in those areas, yeah, look at Netskope.
When you hear the word grit, what or who do you think of?
When I hear the word grit, I think of my parents. I mean, no question. That's it. That's the first and last thing that I think of.
We need more people like you in this business. Thank you, Sanjay.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it. Thanks for tuning in. Feel free to come back every Monday morning to listen to a new guest or go back into the archives when we've done more than 100 episodes. This podcast is a Kleiner Perkins production and the episode was edited by Eric Johnson from Lightning Pod. Thank you all.